Hi, you're listening to Petri.com's MJF Chat Show. I am Mary Jo Foley, aka your Petri.com community magnet, and I am here to interview tech industry experts about various topics that you, our readers and listeners, want to know about. Today's MJF Chat is going to be all about the strengths and weaknesses of the Microsoft Cloud. And my special guest for this chat is Tony Redmond, who is the lead author of Office 365 for IT Pros and a Petri.com contributor. Hi, Tony, and thank you so much for doing this chat with me today.
Oh, the pleasure is entirely mine. Aww. And I believe, and I mean that.
Thank you.
There you go. So soaping right from the start. I'm hoping for an easy ride.
Tony knows me. He knows I'm going to save the tough questions for last, like all good reporters.
Yeah. Just set me up and then hit me over the head with a 2x4.
So this is a very big topic, as everyone can appreciate, especially Tony, because he knows the size of the Office 365 for IT Pros ebook and how often he has to update it. So we've got a hodgepodge of questions, some from listeners and readers, some from me, and we're going to talk about everything from future features to how to manage them to outages and SLAs. So we're going to go all over the map on the Microsoft Cloud here. Okay, so
okay,
my first, all right, you're ready. So first question for me is, can there be too much of a good thing when it comes to features? And the reason I'm asking this is I think you wrote about this on Petri earlier this year, but Microsoft is rolling out so many new features and updates for Microsoft 365 and Office 365 that I can barely keep up. Like every single week, I get an email listing tens of new features coming to my tenant. But this is like every single week, and sometimes there's like 20 or 25 of them. So my question to you is, how can IT pros possibly keep up with this, and is it too much of a good thing?
Okay, that's a big question.
It is,
that's,
I know.
That's kind of like, debate at length. first thing is, let's put some context in it. There's probably, an E3 or E5 tenant, because of course it makes a difference what the licenses you use. Probably see about 250 notifications a year to say we're doing something. Now, 250 notifications doesn't always mean that they deliver 250 new features, because some of those notifications are reissued as features get delayed and whatever. But on then the plus side, this is kind of like adding votes. On the plus side, you got to add in all of the features that get shipped without anybody saying anything to anybody. And there's a bunch of those as well. So you could over a year have to deal between 250 and 275 new things happening inside Office 365. Now, some of those things are very small and some of those things are quite large. A quite large thing would be something like the announcement and the provision of Microsoft Lists, for example, are tasks and teams. Those are big features because they might affect a lot of people. Others will be more minor, like, for example, a change in a Teams meeting policy to force external guests to wait in the lobby, the meeting lobby, before they can join. Those type of things. But the point is, there's a lot of stuff going on. And by the way, it's not Microsoft's problem. This is all Google's problem.
Google's?
It's caused by Google.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Ever since Xavier Soltero went over there and became the GM of Google Workplace, G Suite, whatever, you know, things have gone crazy. There's been so much new stuff happening, and that's because the competition is reignited between Microsoft and Google. That's what I put it down to. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay. All right.
But, you know, back to the real question, is it too much of a good thing? At times, I think it is. And the reason why I say that is that despite everybody loving new functionality, it would be great if we had functionality that worked all the time the way it should do. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm really conscious about in the Microsoft Cloud these days is that I think quality standards have fallen dramatically. in terms of QA and testing. Far too many things get out the door and you say, how could you have done that? I mean,
yep.
it's just terrible.
Well, you just gave me the perfect segue.
That's my brief answer.
Yep. Because we're going to talk about that, right? Yep. So I felt like most of this year so far, Microsoft has done a pretty good job keeping its services up and running during the pandemic. They've been taking a proactive approach around prioritizing them and reconfiguring how they work on their own servers. But then October came and there were some pretty big outages with Microsoft 365, Office 365, and Azure itself. There were things like Exchange Online kept having issues. Admin Center just kept disappearing for people. There were all kinds of Azure authentication issues with other services like Teams and SharePoint, I believe. So, you know, we're talking about your quality comment here. And one of our listeners, Alan Clark, said on Twitter, "Why does it seem like Exchange Server is under an advisory every single day?" So I'd love to hear your comments on what you think is going on here. Is this something to worry about? Like, is this just a blip or is this something that Microsoft needs to address because it's going to become a long-term problem if they don't?
I think it's just indicative of moving parts in a very, very large infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's look at the facts that we know, because none of us know exactly what's happening inside Office 365. Mm. They're adding capacity all the time. Mm-hmm. They're building out data centers. They're adding more of what they call the go local regions in places mm-hmm. like South Africa, Norway, Switzerland, and so forth. They're growing the influence of the substrate all the time. The substrate is terribly important and increasingly important inside Office 365 now, because it's the single point of contact for things like e-discovery compliance and search. So a lot of data has been accumulated there. All of that data has got to be stored and managed. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more storage being added inside the data centers. And there's a lot more AI and machine learning being put in place. Just look at the stuff that's being put in for OWA, where you've got things like predictive text. You know, mm-hmm. look, they've added things like trainable classifiers to allow you to find documents more easily for compliance purposes. They've put in classifiers to do things like communications compliance, so that when I send you a very threatening message, it'll be picked up and I'll be wrapped across the knuckles for being mean to you. You know, but the point is that there's a lot of stuff happening, and all of that machine learning and AI is the result of new services we've been running on new servers spread across all of these data centers. Even things like Play My Email, which mm-hmm. started off in a US only data center because it was linked to Cortana, is now going out international over the next couple of weeks. So there's a lot of moving parts. And when you've got moving parts, you've got the potential for error. The code base that's changing all the time, as well as new features get rolled out, you've just got an incredible amount of complexity. And at mm-hmm. times, I think we see that complexity breaking down as users put strain on the service. And there's no doubt that users are putting more and more strain on the service. We could just see that in Satya Nadella said. He was talking about 6 billion minutes of mm-hmm. collaboration usage on the service. He didn't tell us when that was, whether it was just Teams, whether email is included. No, but even just 6 billion minutes of collaboration, that's a lot. Generated by, look at the latest numbers, 115 million daily active users of Teams. Microsoft was very, very coy about the number of active Office 365 commercial users. They keep on, for some reason, in their results talking about the consumer users, mm-hmm. the folks who are buying the licenses for Word and Excel and stuff like that. But they've stopped giving out the numbers for commercial, which is kind of interesting. And I think that's because that even though there's growth in the places like Teams, overall growth is slowing off a little bit. But anyway, mm-hmm. there's still, my own estimate is that there's about 230, between 230 and 250 million active users of Office 365. So lots of demand, lots of moving services, lots of new services, lots of new storage, and you get strain. And then the strain you see illustrated in breaks. Azure Active Directory broke. There's no doubt. And it is probably the single biggest single point of failure that Office 365 and Microsoft 365 as a whole has got. If Azure AD goes down, bang, you're out of luck. Because without authentication, you can't get the services. So that's the reason why once Azure AD started to have issues, everything started to fall apart in many places. But against that, you got to say that there's a couple of mitigating factors. First off, is that when Azure AD goes down, it's only when you look for new tokens, new authentication, that you're interfered with. So people who use web apps, for example, which cache those tokens, will need to go back unless they need to get a renewed token. Same for mobile apps, same for desktop apps. So that's a mitigating factor. Another mitigating factor is a lot of the apps, including Teams now in its own little way, can work offline without authentication. So I guess we are seeing some things being put in place to make it more survivable. In terms of the SLA, I just had a look today. Microsoft issued the SLA figures for Q3 2020, which is the period I think that most of those problems happened. And so I've been tracking the numbers in the SLA since 2013, and the lowest figure they ever have, the lowest figures ever reported against their 99.9% commitment, which is their financially backed SLA, was 99.94. That was in Q1 2013. Even with all the problems last quarter, they were at 99.97.
Wow. Interesting.
Which is incredible.
That just
speaks. But you know what? That speaks to the fact that in many of the situations you see, many of the incidents you see highlighted in the press, only happen in a single Office 365 region.
Right.
So if they happen in the US, which is the largest region, you get lots of hot air about it. But in fact, you know, EMEA is still running, APAC is still running, Japan is still running, Australia is still running, Germany is still running, France is still running.
Yeah, exactly.
Switzerland, Norway, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So right. there's a huge resilience built into this infrastructure. So it's a difficult question to answer.
It is for us too.
Back to the actual specific, why does Exchange Online seem to have an advisory every day?
Yeah.
But just to identify, why does Exchange Online? I think it's just because Exchange is at the core of so much that happens inside Office 365, and it's not just Exchange; it's also Exchange Online Protection. You see a lot of that come up more so than I believe the core messaging engine.
It's challenging for us as the press because, like, for example, last week I had a Microsoft 365 user pinging me and showing me the advisories he was getting in his admin center, and he was down like an entire day with Exchange, right? And he's like, "Why aren't you writing about this?" And I said, "The way I figure this out is I look online and I wait for people to ping me, and I look to see how many people are complaining to try to get some kind of a gauge about how many people are affected and where. And if it's just like one small piece of the US, I know it's crucial to your business, but I can't write an article every single time like one person is down. Like it's just unwieldy, right? So it's challenging.
Well, to that one person in Kansas, that's really important.
Exactly. And you feel for them because it's like, I can't get email all day, right? So, you know, we talked about the importance of Azure Active Directory to kind of the whole keeping Microsoft 365 and Office 365 running. But my question is, you know, Microsoft is actually moving more and more of its Office 365 services completely over to Azure. Like they haven't been all on Azure for the entire time they've existed. So they, piece by piece, they're bringing more and more of them over to Azure and hosting them on Azure. So I'm curious if you think that'll affect the kinds of outages or the prevalence of outages that we see in the future once these are on Azure completely. I don't know when that will be, but like, is that going to affect it at all, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, some of the mainline services are already there. SharePoint uses Teams is Cosmos DB. SharePoint and OneDrive are using Azure SQL. Exchange, I think, is still physical JBOD storage and SSD in many cases, but it may move. I'm not privy to the engineering plans. I suspect that will be purely an economic decision, because with the amount of storage, remember that once you've got an enterprise mailbox with Exchange, you can get 100 gig of quota plus 100 gig of recoverable items if you're on hold, plus ever expanding archives up to 1 terabyte. So there's a lot of storage being assigned to an individual mailbox right there. So it'll all come down to economics. These guys know how to run spreadsheets. They will know what is the cheapest and most effective form of storage for them. But just in the recent past, I reflect that they did go through the engineering to correct what they call the metabase for Exchange, which is where hot data is cached. That is all on SSD. So, and that was done to make sure that clients got better responsiveness for things like quick lookups against the inbox and for search. So, you know, can they take that over and put it onto Azure and get the same performance and get the same cost? That they're the only ones who can answer that.
Right.
But for, you know, I don't think they would do it without, if they thought that it was going to make Exchange less reliable. That's good. Like, that would be madness.
Yeah, that would be certainly really won't ridiculous.
Do it. It'll cost them more. It certainly won't do it if it'll cost them more.
Yeah, good point. So speaking of costs, and we brought up SLAs briefly already, but I have a reader question about SLAs. And he I believe works for a partner, and he said he was trying to file for a credit on some of the recent outages on behalf of his client.
Yep.
But he said, because of all the hoops he has to jump through, all the filing deadlines, the fact that the places he has to go to figure everything out are multiple different portals, and there's no single thing like a credit portal. He said it's almost impossible to actually get a credit. And I'm curious if you hear this as being an issue from people you talk to, and if you think somebody like that has any hope of actually getting a credit for an outage like we've been seeing like in October and November.
Interestingly, an MVP named Matt Wade, I think his website is jump2365.com, recently published an article where he talked about his experiences of pursuing a service credit with Microsoft, and where he related the story about things like the initial support interaction, which was, oh no, nothing happened, and the various discussions as more detail was given to the support people to say, yeah, it did happen, here's when it happened, this is how long I was out, to eventually getting a support credit. You know, now I don't want this to be represented as another day against support people, because they have a tremendously difficult job.
Right.
And indeed, the first reaction that they're always going to give you is, well, prove that you had an outage. It's up to you to prove if you want to get some value back. And I suspect, you know, people are well able to do the math. They'll be able to look at the SLA and say, well, okay, how much did I actually lose? What can I claim? How much am I going to get versus how much it's going to cost me for the couple of hours, maybe 8 hours, perhaps spread over many days of talking to support? How much is it actually going to be worthwhile? Mm-hmm. And regretfully, that's the kind of world we live in. You could make an argument, Microsoft, with your software capabilities, you could have a portal up there with machine learning backing it up to say, put in your tenant ID and I'll go and process it and find out whether or not we have any records for downtime. But, you know, you got to ask yourself, if you were inside Microsoft, would you be able to make such a proposal to management? Well, let's go and give away a lot of money to our customers by making it much easier for them to claim support credits. Probably not a high engineering priority, I should think.
Mm-hmm. Yep, agree.
But that's me being cynical.
No, I think you're right. Okay, speaking of resiliency, let's stay on that line of questioning. We've got a question from someone whose name is Mark Boat on Twitter. And his question was, should I use Dropbox as a backup to OneDrive? So I'm taking this as a bigger question. Do you think people should still be using third-party services to kind of have a guarantee for some of the Microsoft 365 services? Or do you think that's not really necessary anymore?
I think it depends on the data governance framework that's used inside the organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole point of putting stuff into a single managed space, which I regard as a Microsoft 365 as being, is that you can have common compliance across everything in the space. Once you add a third party space repository like Dropbox, like Box, like Google Drive, you're automatically putting information outside of the managed space, which means then it becomes a lot more difficult to have compliance, retention policies, regulatory records, and all that sort of stuff. Now, some people don't care about that. And by the way, if you don't have E3 or E5 licenses, you don't care because you don't have that kind of functionality anyway. So the point in that case becomes moot. But if you were in a an industry that's under heavy regulation like financial services, then you have a problem, and you've really got to keep everything together because not only do you have to comply with regulations, otherwise you go out of business, but you probably have so many records that you need to keep an eye on. I guess that's a long way of saying it depends on your own business situation, your business requirements. Do I do it? No, I don't. I put everything inside Microsoft 365. Mm-hmm. Am I bothered by that? No, because most of my stuff I have local copies of it on workstations anyway. So yeah, I guess I could have a complete synchronization meltdown and lose data, but touch wood, and I'm grasping a table here as I say this, I have not had that to date.
Good. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about futures. And the reason I'm interested in this is I get asked a lot, and you probably do too, if there'll be someday some new big addition to Office 365 on the scale of Teams. Like I always have people asking me, so what's next? Like they've got Teams, so what's the next big thing, right? And I kind of thought Project Cortex, the knowledge management service, was going to be this, but it doesn't seem like that now because it seems like instead, they're going to be rolling it out in piece parts as optional updates to your existing license. But I'm curious what you think, if you think there will be a next big thing, or do you think one day we'll actually see something like an E7? And Tom Arbuthnot asked on Twitter about our thoughts on this, especially your thoughts. And he said, what's the likelihood Microsoft might add features and licenses beyond E5 in terms of things like more advanced communications and Cortex Syntex service? Like, do you think you'll see more of that? Or will we see like a whole brand new service, something like Teams, but something else? What do you think is going to happen?
Oh, wow. There's a lot of questions there. Will we see a brand new application? I'm kind of wary of making predictions about brand new applications because every time one comes along and Microsoft's marketing muscle goes behind it, You almost have this battle: will it succeed or will it not? Yammer is a great example of that. When that was bought by Microsoft in 2012, over the 2013, 2014, 2015 period, we were told, "Oh boy, Yammer cures even the common cold. Just use it; it'll cure everything." And then we had Office 365 groups, and they were brilliant. And then we had Teams. So you pointed out to Cortex, which to me was never going to be the next big thing because it seemed like it was always going to be most valuable to companies that already had a significant corpus of documents and files inside SharePoint and OneDrive. and needed help in dealing with them, rather than something that was going to be of much use to the average person. Mm-hmm. So the answer is I'm not sure. I don't specialize in crystal ball gazing. In terms of, at least not much. In terms of E5 or E7 or E5 for very special people, there's the minds of marketeers are very deep and obtuse. So whether or not there is some sort of combination of functionality that can be brought together to produce significantly more value for people at a higher cost point, a higher revenue point for Microsoft, remains to be seen. Hmm. Right now, it seems to me that they're stuffing E5 with as much as they can. And that's part of this whole focus that Amy Hood and the financial community within Microsoft have got of driving the average revenue per user, the ARPU, achieved from Office 365 every quarter. You hear it at the analyst briefing every quarter. Mm-hmm. And the reason there is that the higher you drive the ARPU, the higher the profit you get. It's all pure profit, mm-hmm. because all they're doing is selling software licenses. They've already got captive users, so if they can turn them from a $20 a month E3 to $35 a month E5, they give away very little, but they get an extra $15 in profit. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why they're stuffing things full of E5 at the moment and convincing people, you know, that they need advanced add-ons and compliance stuff here, there, and everywhere. So I think there's room for some consolidation and maybe some refactoring of these licenses, perhaps when eventually Microsoft moves Office 365 to become Microsoft 365, because today they still have this dichotomy between what's Office 365 and what's Microsoft 365. Mm-hmm. Largely, I think, because so much of the licensing that they have for Office 365 is tied up in large-scale deals, which are multi-year. So mm-hmm. it's almost like they have to wait for everything to unravel, and then they'll be able to bring everybody together into a happy Microsoft 365 family. And we might see some relicensing then. But mm-hmm. I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint everybody in saying I have no knowledge about a brand new super duper. Maybe there'll be an Xbox application for Office 365, which is integrated into Teams and allows you to play your most precious games inside Teams. Would that suit?
Tony, don't give them any ideas.
Yeah, well,
don't give them ideas.
I was thinking of Paul. I was thinking of Paul Perot. You know, I mean, that would just be right up his street.
It would. I kind of wondered if they might do, I forget what they called this, but like kind of break out some of the features in the E5 license and make them available as an add-on license to E3, so that you could kind of half step up halfway. Because I had a few education customers say to me, I want some of the security things that are in E5, but there's no way we can pay for an E5 license for everyone, right? There's just no way.
Yeah, they have a bunch of add-ons. It's right. Whether or not they would go through all of the licensing complexity. I mean, my gosh,
I know.
if you look at the amount of licenses that people are assigned when they're given one of these plans, it's complex to deal with through the GUI. But then if you're trying to deal with it with tens or hundreds of thousands of people, you're probably not going to do that through GUI. Hmm. And you have to program it with the graph or PowerShell. It just mm-hmm. becomes really, really, really complex.
That,
by the way, is a very big focus I have seen from customers across the world, is that they have realized just how much money they are paying to Microsoft every month for licenses. So there is an increased focus on making sure that those licenses are assigned to the right people, and it's the right licenses mm-hmm. for the right mm-hmm. people, to make sure that their spend is effective. So, you know, you've got these two competing things where customers resisting paying for higher licenses and resisting paying for too many licenses, and Microsoft trying to get everybody to upsell. Mm, so it's kind of interesting. But to be fair, again, just to balance the picture, it's also fair to say that Microsoft hasn't increased the prices of Office 365 since they launched in 2011.
Mm-hmm. I know, which is very surprising to me anyway.
Very surprising. Very surprising. Very laudable.
It is. I know. Even with adding more and more features, they're keeping the price the same, which is definitely laudable. Laudable is a good word. Okay, we get the last laudable question here. So this is my question for you. If you had to say, in your opinion, what is Microsoft's single biggest cloud strength and its single biggest cloud weakness at the moment, what would you say? Putting you on the spot, Tony.
Okay. No. That's actually pretty easy. The weakness is pushing out features without testing.
Yeah.
That's easy. And I, by the way, I do not understand. I do understand why they do this, but I don't at the same time. I understand that they want to stay competitive. I understand from a personal level that PMs and engineering managers want stuff shipped because that helps them, you know, achieve their goals, get bonus paid and stuff like that. Mm. From a corporate level, I don't understand it at all, because when you ship out stuff which is flawed and has bugs in it, it increases your service costs. And service costs, even with all of the automation that they've got, you know, is a very, very big cost bucket. Mm-hmm. So over the years, Microsoft seems to have done a lot to try and restrain service costs for Office 365. At the same time, they allowed the engineering groups to reduce the amount of QA and testing and just ship stuff out, which is not ready to go. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is the biggest weakness they've got. Mm-hmm. The biggest strength they've got is their size and the fact that even though we might moan a lot at times about you know, the performance or whatever, there's no doubt that they have put in place a truly worldwide global network to link all their data centers together with mm-hmm. an enormous thousands of local contact points to minimize the transit from your local network to their network, because that is a weakness in itself. If your network is bad and your ISP is bad, you're going to have an unhappy time getting to Office 365. But once you get inside the Microsoft network, because of all of the investment they've put in place, you know, things work pretty well. So mm-hmm. their size, the investment they've made in data centers, the investment they've made in networks, these are huge advantages. Mm. And they're just rolling up their installed base to create this huge number of Office 365 users. Imagine, you know, at the last results that we're talking about, the overall size of the installed base, they seem to be given some hints that only about 30% of the installed base remains to be rolled over. So
yeah,
after they've done all that, what do they do next?
Right. Maybe go after consumers. That seems to be an obsession that never goes away for them.
Could be.
Anyway, that's good. That's a good summary. So thank you very much, Tony. Always a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for taking the time.
And you too. Yep. It's great. Great talking to you.
Great. And for everyone listening to this right now or reading the transcript, I'll be putting up more information soon on Petri about who my next guest is going to be. And once you see that, you can submit questions directly on Twitter for the guest using the hashtag MJFChat. In the meantime, if you know of anyone else or even yourself who might make a good guest for one of these MJF chats, please do not hesitate to drop me a note. Thank you very much.